morning. It's Monday, June 29th, and this is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. state of Mississippi removes a racist symbol from its flag.
My parents and grandparents experienced much terrorism and tyranny under that flag, and so I'm hoping and hopeful that it will change to bring forth a symbol that's more unifying and represents the diversity of Mississippi.
And Greek sex workers struggle during COVID-19, plus Malawi has a new president. These stories and more are next. Our top story today: protests continue in America against police brutality and racism, 1 month after the death of George Floyd in police custody sparked worldwide demonstrations. This weekend, one person died and another was injured in a shooting late on Saturday in Louisville, Kentucky's Jefferson Square Park, which has become a center for protests against the police killing of a black woman named Breonna Taylor in her home in March. The weekend's victim in Louisville was 27-year-old Tyler Charles Girth. A suspect identified by an arrest citation as Stephen Nelson Lopez has been arrested in connection to Girth's shooting death. Authorities and protesters said Lopez had taken part in demonstrations but was disruptive and had been asked to leave by other protesters before he opened fire. At least a dozen people have died in demonstrations since late May, according to media reports, with many more injured. Despite the dangers, the protests show no signs of slowing down. For more, VOA's Ian Bior looks at the sustained motivation of these uprisings with reporting from VOA's Aisha Sarai.
Advocates for racial justice say that the protests seen across the United States in the past month are not new, organic, or solely because of George Floyd's death. The movement has been built on years of organizing and a growing list of individuals killed at the hands of police. Cornell W. Brooks is the former president of the civil rights group, NAACP.
It arrives at a moment in which the public's patience for police misconduct has been expended. So the George Floyd video arrives after the video of Philando Castile in Minneapolis, after the video of Jamar Clark in Minneapolis, but also after the video of Tamir Rice, Walter Scott, Laquan McDonald.
Black Lives Matter!
Defund police!
Some demonstrators have noted how the COVID-19 pandemic has contributed to the sustained motivation of nationwide protest. Hilda Johnson is a protester in Washington, D.C.
Like, I already have to fight systemic racism. I have to fight, like, a virus that I do not understand, that no one understands. And you're still killing me on national TV? Like, just something's got to give.
This year, social media, fundraisers, and petitions have accompanied rallies in the streets.
You have the highest unemployment rate you've ever seen before. People actually have the time right now to go out into the streets. Now you realize that you and your friends can, you know, create a petition, can sign something, can, you know, get folks out on the street, can volunteer to bring water.
Black Americans who have taken to the streets in recent weeks note that discrimination and violence against them is nothing new. Like this protester, who gave her first name as Sonia.
I live it, right? Because I was born a black woman, right? So this is not something that I'm just coming to realize.
Activists note that an increase of organizing and educating on social media has contributed to wider awareness of the movement. Former NAACP President Brooks.
Young people crafting hashtags, crafting messages, engaged in serial strategic disruption of daily life, globalizing the message, tying it to a set of public policy reforms, and pushing the conversation, changing the civic vocabulary.
While specific circumstances of the 2020 protests for the Black Lives Matter movement are different than previous ones, Brooks believes the current movement is the result of years of organizing.
Based on my 25 years of doing this work around the country, this is a serious moment at the dawn of a movement, I thought so 5 years ago. I don't think I was wrong.
Brooks and grassroots activists are confident this current movement will affect real change, noting it has already sparked conversation about police reform in both the local and federal governments. Ayan Bior with reporting from Aisha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
One thing that is keeping protesters going is the feeling that the demonstrations are leading to changes, in particular as numerous cities have begun taking steps to cut funding to police departments. But on the symbolic level, changes are taking place much faster as protesters pull down statues and monuments to historical racists and demand changes to names and other symbols. The latest success for protesters has been in the deep southern state of Mississippi, which was a member of a group of states which rebelled against the U.S. in order to preserve slavery in the 19th century. Mississippi also fiercely defended segregation of black and white people in the 20th century. Mississippi has a 38% black population and the last state flag with the Confederate emblem that's widely seen as racist. But over the weekend, Mississippi lawmakers voted to remove a symbol of the Confederacy from Mississippi's state flag.
By a vote of 85 yeas and 34 nays, resolution passes.
Black Mississippi resident Reverend C.J. Rhodes had this reaction.
My parents and grandparents experienced much terrorism and tyranny under that flag. As a younger Mississippian, a millennial, it represents darker days of our state when our state government and various others used it as a symbol of supremacy. And so I'm hoping and hopeful that it will change to bring forth a symbol that's more unifying and represents the diversity of Mississippi.
All of Mississippi's public universities stopped flying the state flag years ago because of the now removed Confederate symbol. A bombshell report by the New York Times over the weekend claims that Russia paid militants in Afghanistan to kill U.S. troops and that U.S. President Donald Trump knew about it but didn't act. The Times report claims that American intelligence officials concluded months ago that a Russian military intelligence unit secretly offered bounties to Taliban-linked militants for killing U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The report said the Russians offered rewards for successful attacks last year at a time when the U.S. and Taliban were holding talks to end the long-running war. Russia called the report nonsense. The Times quoted a Taliban spokesman denying that its militants have such a deal with the Russian intelligence agency. The newspaper, citing unnamed officials familiar with the intelligence, said the findings were presented to Trump and discussed by his National Security Council in late March. Officials developed potential responses, starting with a diplomatic complaint to Russia, but the White House has yet to authorize any step, the report said. But Trump said he was never told of the Russian bounties. Trump responded to the allegations saying, quote, "Nobody briefed or told me, Vice President Pence, or Chief of Staff Mark Meadows about the so-called attacks on our troops in Afghanistan by Russians." But Democrats slammed Trump after the report came out. Here's Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi.
We'll find out if he has been briefed, and it was in his daily brief. But if it were not, what does that say about the concern that those who brief the president have about not going anywhere near the Russia issue with this president? This is appalling. This is as bad as it gets. And yet the president will not confront the Russians on this score, denies being briefed, whether he is or not his administration knows.
Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden also weighed in.
It's truly shocking revelation that if the Times report is true, I emphasize again, is that President Trump, the commander-in-chief of American troops serving in a dangerous theater of war, has known about this for months, according to the Times, and done worse than nothing. Not only has he failed to sanction or impose any kind of consequences on Russia for this egregious violation of international law, Donald Trump has continued his embarrassing campaign of deference and debasing himself before Vladimir Putin. He has this information, according to the Times, and yet he offered to host Putin in the United States and sought to invite Russia to rejoin the G7.
That was presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. An exit poll shows the incumbent conservative Polish president Andrzej Duda with the most votes in Poland's presidential election on Sunday, but he is short of the 50% required for an outright win in the first round. If the poll is confirmed by official results, Duda will face centrist Warsaw Mayor Rafał Trzaskowski in a runoff on July 12th. Poland's State Electoral Commission has said it would release the final official results by Wednesday evening. Whether Duda ultimately wins a second five-year term in 2 weeks' time will determine whether the ruling nationalist party that backs him, called Law and Justice, keeps its near monopoly on political power in Poland. The party has been in conflict with the European Union over laws that have given it control over top courts and key judicial bodies, something the 27-nation bloc has denounced as an erosion of democratic European values. French President Emmanuel Macron's centrist party faced a drubbing on Sunday in municipal elections. The vote, delayed for months by the coronavirus crisis, delivered a dire verdict for the president, who could emerge from the vote without winning a single contest in a major city 2 years before he faces re-election. Exit polls showed the Greens and their leftist allies winning control of Lyon and Marseille and ahead in the race for Bordeaux City Hall. In Paris, an exit poll showed socialist mayor Anne Hidalgo holding on to her job after a shambolic campaign by Macron's camp. Hong Kong police arrested at least 53 people on Sunday after scuffles erupted during a relatively peaceful protest against planned national security legislation to be implemented by the mainland Chinese government. The proposed national security law has raised concerns among Hong Kong democracy activists and some foreign governments that Beijing is further eroding the extensive autonomy promised when Britain handed the territory back to China in 1997. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists led by Germany's University of Göttingen report they've discovered two super-Earths orbiting a red dwarf star only 11 light-years away. A super-Earth has a mass greater than Earth, but much less than the ice giants Uranus and Neptune. The scientists, writing of their discovery in the journal Science, suggest that the planets Gliese 887b and Gliese 887c are located within their star's habitable zone where water can exist in liquid form. Since it's a red dwarf, dimmer and smaller than our sun, its habitable zone is much closer to the star. According to the study, Gliese 887b and 887c orbit their star every 9.3 and 21.8 days, respectively. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Global coronavirus cases exceeded 10 million on Sunday, marking a major milestone in the spread of the respiratory disease that has so far killed almost 500,000 people in 7 months. The figure is roughly double the number of severe influenza illnesses recorded annually, according to the World Health Organization. The U.S. remains the global hotspot for COVID-19 with more than 2.5 million cases and more than 125,000 deaths. For at least three consecutive days, the number of confirmed U.S. cases leapt by more than 40,000, one of the world's largest surges. In many states, people under 35 years of age accounted for a large percentage of new cases. More tests are also coming back positive, up to 25% in some areas. The surge in cases has been most pronounced in southern and western states that did not follow health officials' recommendations to wait for a steady decline in cases before reopening. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar warned on CNN that, quote, the window is closing, end quote, for the country to get the pandemic under control. Brazil recorded over 38,000 new cases of the novel coronavirus and over 1,100 additional deaths, the health ministry said Saturday. The nation has now registered over 1.3 million total confirmed cases of the virus and over 57,000 deaths. In China, Beijing has ramped up coronavirus testing efforts, testing about a third of the capital's population so far, a city official said Sunday, as authorities seek to control a renewed outbreak stemming from a wholesale market in mid-June. By noon Sunday, Beijing had collected over 8 million patient samples for testing and completed over 7 million tests. Indonesia reported nearly 1,200 new coronavirus cases and 34 deaths on Sunday, taking the total number of infections to over 54,000 and fatalities to over 2,700. Russia on Sunday reported over 6,700 new coronavirus cases, a figure that keeps the daily rise below 7,000 for a third day in a row for the first time since late April. The new cases take the cumulative nationwide tally to over 630,000. The country's Coronavirus Response Center said 104 people had died of the virus in the last 24 hours, bringing the death toll to 9,073. Japan announced 60 new coronavirus infections in Tokyo on Sunday, the highest daily total since May 4th. Meanwhile, Australia's Victoria state will implement mandatory coronavirus tests for returning travelers after a sharp spike in infections over the past 2 weeks. The country's second most populous state had 49 new cases on Sunday, its highest in more than 2 months, and the 12th consecutive day of double-digit rises. The rest of Australia has seen almost no infections. And in the Czech Republic, the daily number of new cases jumped to 260, the highest since April 8th, mainly due to a surge in an eastern mining area. And in Greece, businesses have been slowly reopening, scrambling to make up for lost work after a shutdown of more than 2 months due to the COVID-19 pandemic. But the relaunch isn't easy, especially for those in marginalized professions such as sex workers, who say they are hardest hit. Anthi Karasava reports for VOA on how registered brothels and sex workers in Greece are being forced to go underground to survive.
In the small city of Larissa, north of the Greek capital, Sula Levridou operates one of the region's top brothels. For years, she says, business was booming before the COVID-19 pandemic struck. Now times are tough. There is little work, Alevridou says, almost nothing. This industry, she says, has been hurt badly, and it feels as if workers are coming out of a war, all of them injured. Those who manage to recover will survive, but it is tough. Under a new set of government health and safety regulations, brothels must now implement new protective measures to prevent coronavirus infection. They require sex workers to wear masks, keep their heads a distance from customers, and take on appointments of no more than 15 minutes, all measures the industry has agreed to. However, orders to register clients' names and contact numbers, as well as to keep them in orderly lines outside brothels, have prostitutes balking, saying the measures strike at the very foundation of their service, anonymity. Keeping records of clients, their names and contacts may be right, Alevridou says. It assists health authorities in tracking and tracing potential cases. Sex workers, though, she says, cannot play the role of police officers. The sex trade is a different business altogether, she says. Cashless payments now ordered also are proving a problem. A married man, Alevridou says, cannot go to a brothel and pay with his cash or credit card. His family probably shares the same card, and he's bound to have problems once his wife or son or daughter get a whiff of the bordello charges. Critics say the measures will be impossible to impose. Thanos Askitis, a leading sex therapist in Greece, explains. It's highly unlikely, he says, that these measures will be observed. Ultimately, he says, they will add no further protection to the industry. It will all boil down to luck or lack of it in containing the crisis on this front, he says. So far, no cases have been recorded nationwide involving Greek sex workers. However, the financial beating the industry has suffered in recent months, plus the new measures imposed, have many of them returning to the streets, branching out online, or just going underground to eke out a living. The crisis is much more prevalent in big cities such as Athens, where most sex workers are already operating illegally. Authorities say they count about 800 brothels, but only a third of them are legally listed. While the Greek government has offered financial assistance to those who have lost their income because of the COVID-19 crisis, no adequate provisions have been made for the sex industry. To qualify for the aid payments, workers must show they are operating legally and have been paying taxes. That is impossible, though, for the uncounted numbers of unregistered sex workers here, mainly migrants, who cannot do so because they lack legal status. Unlike other countries across Europe and beyond, sex workers here have received little, if any, support from local charity groups. Antika Rasava for VOA News, Athens, Greece.
A Jerusalem court has ordered the release of a former Air Force general and leading activist opposed to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's rule, whose arrest prompted hundreds to protest outside the Israeli leader's residence. AP's Charles de la Desma has more.
General Amir Haskel had been a leader of the protest movement against Netanyahu, demanding the longtime leader steps down while facing charges of fraud, breach of trust, and accepting bribes. Haskel and several others were detained on Friday in what police say was an illegal demonstration because the protesters blocked roads. Now his lawyer has told Israeli Army Radio the court has released him without conditions, saying protesting is the foundation of democracy. I'm Charles de la Desma.
Malawi's new president, Lazarus Chakwera, on Sunday took the oath of office in the capital, Lilongwe. The swearing-in ceremony came after he defeated two candidates, including former president Peter Mutharika, in a tightly contested presidential election rerun held last week. Malawi's courts nullified a first election, which took place in May 2019, due to irregularities. Many Malawians expect Chakwera's administration to start implementing its campaign promises. For VOA, Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre.
There was jubilation from hundreds of people who gathered at the Bingu International Convention Center in the capital, Lilongwe Sante, to witness Chakwera and his vice president, Saulos Chilima, taking oath of office from Chief Justice Andrew Nyilenda.
I, Dr. Lazarus Makate Chakwera, do solemnly swear that I will well and truly perform functions of the high office of President of the Republic of Malawi, so help me God.
The presidential election rerun was held after the Constitutional Court nullified last year's election, which gave former President Peter Mutharika a second term because of massive irregularities. In the court-sanctioned polls, Chakwera, leader of the opposition Malawi Congress Party, was a candidate for the Tonse Alliance, which comprised nine political parties, including United Transformation Movement, led by former Vice President Saulos Chilima. He ran against former President Mutharika, leader of Democratic Progressive Party, who made an alliance with Atupele Muluzi, leader of the opposition, United Democratic Front. A little-known candidate, Peter Kuwani, of the opposition Mbakuwako Movement for Development Party, had no alliance partner. Chakwera won with 2.6 million votes, according to results announced Saturday, while Mutharika came second with 1.7 million votes, and Kuwani won 32,400 votes. In his acceptance speech Sunday, Chakwera pledged to develop the country beyond the expectations of Malawians.
So I pledge to run Malawi well, for that is the surest path that has long been in ruins, riddled with the potholes of greed and corruption. And in making this pledge, I'm accepting this call to serve you with joy and holy fear. For I am duty bound by God and to God, and all of you.
Chakwera also appealed to those who did not vote for him to not fear being neglected.
I know that there are many of you who did not vote for me in this election, and perhaps the prospect of my presidency fills you with fear and grief. But I want you to remember one thing. So long as I am its president, it will be a home in which you too will prosper.
However, many Malawians say there is nothing more they are expecting from the new president other than meeting his campaign promises. In their campaign messages, the Tonse Alliance leaders promised the creation of 1 million jobs within the first year, reduction of prices of fertilizers by over 400%, and curbing corruption, which murdered the Mutharika administration. Political analyst Mustafa Hussein said it's now time for the new president to start honoring those promises.
What they need to do is fulfill their promises, put the machinery in place that will focus on the implementation of what they promised in the manifestos, including job creation, the reduction of fertilizer price, among others. I think this time around, they know the cost of making empty promises.
Patricia Galliard is the general secretary of the United Transformation Movement Party, a key partner in the Tonse Alliance. She told VOA the new government will even do more than what was promised during campaign period.
Issues of good infrastructure, education, health programs, issues of empowerment of women and men, youth, and the status of Malawians at large, which are going to provide to individual person that when he is or she is in her home, he should be saying, yes, I'm in a new Malawi, which I was looking for.
President Chakwera is expected to outline more of his government's development plans during his inauguration on July 6. Lameck Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
I saw her today at the reception.
British rock band The Rolling Stones are threatening President Donald Trump with legal action for using their songs at his rallies despite cease and desist directives. The British rockers said in a statement Sunday that their legal team is working with music rights organization BMI to stop use of their material in Trump's re-election campaign. The band said, quote, if Donald Trump disregards the exclusion and persists, then he would face a lawsuit for breaking the embargo and playing music that has not been licensed, end quote. The Trump campaign has yet to comment. The Rolling Stones' 1969 classic, You Can't Always Get What You Want, was a popular song for Trump campaign events and was played again at the close of Trump's recent rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us on voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bungani, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Stay healthy, stay safe, and have a great day.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am
a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And to AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.